Accession number 18463, reel 34.
Reel 34.
I guess it's probably to part of the engineer, combat engineer battalion that is around this area. And that's probably the two chaps who rushed across the water as we've been withdrawing from the Marquee. May have been going to there, I don't really know. Anyway, they suddenly realise, of course, the battle's going on all around them. And the lorry suddenly veers into the ditch and it cocked at a fair old angle, the engine running. And these three chaps leapt out and came running back past us. And I must say there were one or two jokes thrown at them, but they're not terribly interested. They whistle off back down to the safety of wherever it is they're going to. And we march on, and there's the CO on the left-hand side of the road talking to the Australian CO, who is just beginning to form his battalion HQ. Battalion HQ has been overrun up where the Australians are. Come back to us, and they're forming up on the left-hand side of the road. CO called me over, asked who we were, and I told him. And he said to me, "Where's your equipment?" I said, "Well, I had to take my pouches off and give them to one of the other chaps who's lost his, and he's on an LMG, so, you know, he needs him." He said, "Okay." Pointed out where B Company was. Well, I knew where they were, but he pointed it out to me and said, "Right, off you go up there." So we went up, and I dropped the lads off just off the road, just on the below the crest of the hill, and went up to see the company commander and reported to him. And he obviously asked casualties and what have you. And he said, "Oh, you've got Mr. Brown's pistol. I'll have that. I've lost mine." So I said, "Oh, all right then." Gave it to him. Gave him the whole lot. He said, "I don't want the belt and the holster." And I said, "Well, I don't want it either, so, you know." Gave it to him. I was a bit miffed about this. I just got it and had it 10 minutes, and I'm sure everybody thought, "Well, that serves him right for taking it from the other chap." Anyway, he said, "I've lost mine back where you were, you know, milling about down there. If you find it, you can have this one back." And he pointed then out to a position. He said, "Dig in on this little ridge to the right hand side." And went back down to the platoon, and I said, "Look, company commander's lost his 45. If anybody sees it, it was a fatal thing to say. If anybody sees it, pick it up and let him have it back, and I'll have mine back." And Bill said, "Don't bother." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because I've already got his pistol in my pack." I said, "Oh, go on, give it to him back, and I'll have mine." He said, "Not likely." So my pistol's gone already. I'm really getting a bit forlorn. Anyway, we move up onto this little ridge. It's bare, sandy soil with some bushes on the front. And we're a bit thin on the ground, so I form platoon H. We're looking north, incidentally, towards the Australian position and the end of the Canadian, the gun, where the guns had been, aren't they? And I put platoon HQ on the right-hand side, where I can see down onto the road, and Bill's section, I line up on the left-hand side. We can't go forward, which we normally would have done, because it's just too steep there. So we dig in back and rely on the bushes to sort of hide our heads and things like that. The other two sections I put together now as one group. So we've got Biggie in charge because he's a senior fella, and Bethel, and they dig in as two sections, but really combined. And they dig in on the reverse slope, because a reverse slope shoot is always good, because they're liable to come up the reverse slope anyway. But if they burst up over us on the top, the reverse slope labs can sort of deal with them as they come over the top. Sometime later, the New Zealand FFO comes over. He's Lieutenant Roxburgh. He might have been a captain by that time. He'd been a lieutenant in February and got an MC with us. And he said, "Well, I've got two signallers and myself. I'll dig in on your right-hand side, and you can count on us as infantry when they come, you know, if they attack and come zooming up this slope here." It was rather good, really. It was quite good of him, really, to do that. He dug in on my right, so I've now extended my line by about 3 or 4, 5, 6 yards, something like that. And we're quite a little defensive force now, about 20 of us, and of course the three New Zealanders. Anyway, shortly after that, I got a message over the radio. I'm dreadful on radios. I can never remember the call sign. Couldn't even remember them now. I think it was Octopus Queen 2 Charlie or something stupid like that. And I'm always saying to Will, and I will be for the next week, what's the call sign? What's the call sign? And the lads gradually pick it up, and as soon as the radio they mimic me and say, what's the call sign? What's the call sign? It's all pretty amusing. And they came up and said, ammunition casualties. Now that, of course, is the first thing platoon commander is supposed to do. Second commanders do it first, report to platoon commander. But I hadn't actually forgotten it, but I'd actually done it by virtue of getting ammunition back where Battalion HQ was. I hadn't got any 9mm, incidentally, so I've only got two and a half mags left. And there's one or two grenades short, things like that. So I look for something to make a list on, and all I can find is a little Korean notebook and a stub of pencil. I'll start to do it. And Chris Lawrence calls over and says, I've got plenty of ammunition and grenades over here. If you come, send the platoon sergeant over and pick it up. So I send Bill over to collect what we want. Having made a little rough list of what we wanted, he comes back. And I don't know what time it was, might have been an hour late or something like that. Time is a little bit immaterial. I get called over to the company commander, and I expect he's going to say to me, right, I'm going to put a sergeant in as platoon commander, and you can, you know, take over your section again. And I got a suspicion that he has a corporal in his company HQ. What a useless corporal. He'd been a sergeant, and they busted him down, and the company commander, who obviously didn't have any faith in him at all, made him in charge of his LMG group. But that's another story. And I thought, well, they're going to put him in charge of the platoon now. Seemed reasonably obvious. Go over and have a talk with him, and he's nothing of the sort. He talks to me about what my plans are when they, you know, when they if there's attack up the gully, and how am I going to cover the forward slope, this higher ridge from which they've been shooting down on us. And I said, well, I haven't got enough men to put anybody out there, and neither as of any of the others. So I'll just have to cover it with the LMG fire. I've got one LMG up there. I can bring the other two forward. Unfortunately, the mortar is... I don't think the mortar could have been drawn, because I haven't seen it, and I don't think it was abandoned. And I also haven't got the rocket launcher, so there's nothing else really I can do about that. And he agrees, yes, that's okay, we'll maintain that, okay. And sends me off back to the platoon, and I think they're as amazed as I am, but I'm now commanding a platoon, which surprised them a little bit, and me more than them, I'm sure. The day goes on, and we begin to settle down, and I guess it was after midday. I would guess it's after midday. Might have been about 1300, 1400, something like that. Chris Lawrence calls over and says, I'm going out to bring in the casualties, the dead. Would you like to come with me and get yours? So we go off through, and I walk through his platoon, in actual fact. And I see John White, my friend, there. And he's always got a collar and tie on. He's always looking immaculate as can. And he's sitting in at the end of his slit trench, sitting bolt upright, and with his collar and tie on, his sten across his lap there, fast asleep. Go on through, and they're getting out, Lance Corporal Innes, they're just pulling him up out of his trench. And they've been a bit careful, because the blood collects in the clothing, obviously, and pours out all over if you're not. And of course, suddenly there's a gusher, and they leap back and drop him in again. And they're pulling him out, and there's, on the left, is Tom Amos, not a friend, from Hong Kong days. He'd been wounded at Middlesex Hill, come back Christmas, and now he's dead. And I couldn't help noticing he was just laying there with his head on his arm, as if he was asleep, but his face was going a yellow colour, just like jaundice, like people look when they got very bad jaundice. Go on past him. I've got a couple of the lads with me. I managed to wake two up and take them with me, one of which is Barnes, who's always ready to come out and do something. So we're taking it fairly cautiously, because we don't know if they're still back down on our little ridge waiting for us. And we go on down, and it seems reasonably clear. Come to the path, so I send the two lads off down to the left, down to where we left Jack Oates. I just got that faint hope, maybe I was wrong. Maybe he's still alive. You never know, do you? And so off they go down there. although we've left him rather a long time if he was alive. And I look around and I'd remembered when I was running forward, something green on the right-hand side as I ran forward, and I suddenly realised it was probably the platoon commander's pack. They had their green equipment whilst we had the old khaki web and stuff. And just there is his map, which I picked up and put in my pocket. I had a quick look at it, and of course it's the map of the Fish Hills and marked up, so I thought I'd better keep that away because no one wants to see a marked map. I went forward, but I didn't look over the top. Had I just looked over the ridge there forward, that's where the guy who I'd shot was dead with his Thompson still with him. Anyway, I go back, go down the path, and say to the lads, look, I'm going to go off and look for Ken Sutton now. Now, for some reason or other, I thought he'd been shot in the riverbed, and I don't know why I thought that, but I mean, I did. And I went off down the gully on my own, which is a bit dangerous because, you know, you should always have somebody with you covering you. Came to an American helmet, blood-stained American helmet in the riverbed, and I guess then that the two that I'd been shooting at, I'd probably hit one of them as well, and his helmet had rolled down there into the riverbed. Or it could have been the rock unit going up, one of them might have got hit or something, but it looked a bit suspicious. Went down to the end, taking it very, very careful now, because there are some houses there up on a high bank, and if anybody's in there, I'd be in a spot of bother. So I came up, I just literally peeped round the corner, and I could see the road about 20, 30 yards away, nobody on it, and it's obviously that's the place which they will eventually call the Ford. Don't decide not to go in the houses alone, because it would have been darn stupid to do that. Went back up again, and they're milling around Jack Oates now, because they can't get his arms and legs straightened out. So I said, I'll have a go. But I just couldn't do it. I couldn't bend his arms straight around and his legs and what have you. So I said, well, I can't do it. And we put him on the stretcher just like he was, and they carted him off. And I said to Barney, I can't find Ken Sutton anywhere. He said, well, no, you're going the wrong way. He's up and over in the paddy forward. And I hadn't realised that, and I then realised that in all probability it was the fire from 4 platoon that had hit him. May have been. I mean, it was coming from 2 directions, so we can't say for sure. So I go forward. So I said, well, I'll go forward. You go off with the stretcher, get shot at Jack, and come back for me, and we'll pick up Ken, who is hitting the head and dead as far as I could see. And get up over the ridge, and I could see him, and he's laying tight up under the paddy bun. That's why we hadn't seen him. If he'd been out, we'd have known he was there, where he was, but he was tight under the paddy bun, laid full length, out straight, with his feet together. And I'm walking up to him, not very keen on seeing him, poor old chap, because he hadn't been long with us, but he was a very, very nice chap. Coming up, and I thought, his foot moved. What can't have done? So going up, speed up a little bit. I saw his foot move again. So I run up to him, and he's alive, I can't believe it. But he's got a hole in his head, a jagged hole in his skull, double the size of a half crown, I guess. All jagged bones sticking out. But his brain has come out, and there's a lump of brain nearly as big as my fist. No, half as big as my fist. Sticking out in a great, like a great blowout of gum sort of thing. Grey, slimy stuff around it. And I kneel down beside him, and he says, my bloody head doesn't half ache, and went up and brushed it, which didn't do it a lot of good, I guess. So I hold his arms down, and kneeling up, I could see over the paddy band, and I could see Chris Lawrence. I call out to him, Mr. Lawrence, he's alive, he's alive. Send someone down. And he comes down then with another stretcher and some morphine. And we cut open his sleeve and give him some morphine. But unfortunately, we've got nothing to mark his forehead. He's supposed to put an M on his forehead if he has morphine. Because you mustn't have too much of the wretched stuff. And we there's no blood, there's no mud, there's no nothing. We haven't got a pencil or anything to mark on his forehead. So I said to him, well, I'll go back with him. You know, we'll put him on the stretcher. We'll get a man on each corner. and I'll stay holding its head so that it doesn't wobble about too much. And we set off across the paddy fields. I'm trying to hold its head steady because the jagging bone goes through the brain. I can see he's not going to last very long. But unfortunately, it's all paddies up and over and up and over. By the time we get to the path, the four bearers are absolutely exhausted, and I am as well, because I'm trying to hold his head and steady, you know, the thing at the same time. And they said we'd have to go up and over because we're not strong enough to go round the long path round. So Chris said, well, I think you better keep going. By the time we got four more new bearers down here to relieve you, you know, the poor old chap might be gone. So we struggle up the side of the hill. It's not a very big hill, it's quite a reasonably low hill, over the top, through where four platoon are. But unfortunately, it's got gullies everywhere, a little washed out with the rain, I guess, you know, and we're struggling along these, and poor old Ken's wobbling about all over the place. But at least he's no longer conscious, because the morphine's sent him to sleep. Get him down onto the road, take him along to the RAP. Now, at the RAP, there's the New Zealand MO is there, so presumably ours. We didn't have an MO that day, I guess. I didn't see him, and I didn't see him later. But the New Zealand MO's come up, and I think he's a bit surprised, because he's just had dead ones till now, and now he's got a live one at last. So he takes over him, has a look at him, and he made up something which I wish I'd thought of it at the time before we ever started to move. He got a dressing, not a shell dressing, a field dressing, and he wrapped it into a circle, just about 3 or 4 inches, I guess it was, round on the outside, hole in the centre, and gently slipped this over so that it would stop the brain from being penetrated by the jagged skull. And he said, we'll try and get him down to the field ambulance. So he got a jeep, his jeep, I guess, and we laid him across the bonnet of the jeep, and one of the New Zealanders sat on the bonnet with him, holding the stretcher on, and trying to hold Ken on. And the driver, he said to the driver, do your best. I mean, Korean roads is a ridiculous thing to say. Do your best, but try and miss all the bumps you possibly can. And they went off, and I said to him, what's the chance? He said, well, not a lot. If we can get him to the field ambulance, he might have a chance. But it's pretty unlikely that he'll be alive when he gets to the field ambulance. So I guess we've done it a bit. Looking round, I thought, well, I send the lads off then. But I thought, well, I'd better wait until the RAP have sorted out Jack Oates and Tom and George Innes. And they're doing it, you know. They're far braver than I am. They're stretching them out and taking their effects and what have you, and wrapping them in blankets. So I wait until that's done. And then I go back and report to the company commander that we've disposed of anyone. And I'll be honest, I expected another telling off now for leaving poor old Ken out there all that time. But we've been convinced he was dead. I mean, Barney had seen him hit in the head and seen it fly all over the place, and you don't usually survive a hit from the top on the top of the head here, but slightly back of the skull. Anyway, that all seems to be going reasonably well. We've got all the casualties sorted out and cleared up, and we go back and settle down now for as soon as stand to, which will be about, I guess, at this time of year, it was probably about, 1600, I guess, we probably would be standing to 50%. It'll be 50% all night. The Australians are fighting pretty fiercely down the road there, and the Canadians have now moved a company over to, they're now sitting just above where we had spent the night of the 23rd, 24th, and we can see the FFO calls me over and said, I reckon they're Chinese. And we're looking, and there's like an overhang of rock there. And we can see this medium machine gun crew digging in there. And the saws flying out. But they do look like Chinese, I had to admit. They did, because they had a fairly padded uniform. Not padded, but fairly bulky uniform. And they had it from a distance. They did look a bit Chinese. I said, well, I don't think so. I think they're Canadians. So it's signalers both wanted to fire on them because they hadn't fired that day, and gunners always like to shoot something up. So I said, well, I still think they're Canadians. They might be Chinese because they were moving about a bit fast, you know, but I don't think so. I think they're Canadians. So he said, well, all right then. I've got some boxes of ammunition abandoned by the 4-2 mortars, American 4-2 mortars down there. And I can't see these, funny enough. I don't see these boxes of ammunition, but he's obviously been sorting them out a lot longer than me. He said, I'll fire a salvo down there and just see what reaction it gets, you know, see if they leap about a bit or anything. So he fires a salvo or two down there onto these ammunition boxes and tells me that he's hit them and there's been no explosion, so we guess they must have been empty. But the if Canadians they are, make no sign at all. They just go on, you know, digging in and doing the normal things that you'd expect them to do. They don't take any notice of this. These gunners, signalers, are saying, "Come on, let's drop some on them." And I said, "I don't think so." As it happened, B Company of the Canadians had come over from the other side. We didn't know this. Come right from the other side of their position, and we're now digging in on this base. I guess it must have been some of their MMGs. I'm still not sure, and events later don't help me to convince me that they are. But anyway, night falls, and we've settled in fairly well on the positions, and a message comes over that the Australians are withdrawing. They'll be withdrawing through some. They'll come through about, oh, I don't know, 2,300, something like that, perhaps 2,200. We must expect them. So it all goes quiet and uneventful evening. There's no attack made on us. And funny enough, it's all pretty quiet. Again, the guns are probably firing, but they never register to me, so I can't be sure. I'm sure they're firing, but I can't be sure that they were. Anyway, fairly, we're hoping to. We'll stand down, hopefully, to 50% when the Australians come through us. And about 2,300, the FFO calls over and says, they're here. And we could just see the vague shapes going across down on the road there and the sort of flap of feet and what have you. And they pass through us and presumably go right down to the rear of our position. And we settle down now because we know the Chinese are on the way through, you know, chasing up close behind them. I should add something I'd just forgotten was that that strange machine gun that we saw, which I thought was Canadians, and the New Zealanders wanted to have a pop-up because they thought it was Chinese. At about 2,200, there's a burst of tracer from that gun, and it's fired down on the road, and it must have hit a big drum of petrol or something like that, I guess, because it burst into flame there. And we were chatting about this. We didn't know whether maybe it was the Canadians lighting up a signal for the Australians to aim for, or whether it was the Chinese lighting it up so they could see. But we never did find out what there was. But that burnt all the time, and that's exactly where the Australians hit the road and came up on the road and came through us. So I'd like to think that it was Canadians who were lighting the way for the Aussies, but it didn't do a lot of good because you could also see, they'd have been able to see, we couldn't see them because there was a little hill in the front, but anybody else would have been able to see them. Anyway, they passed through, and about midnight, I guess, we hear that we're about to change. This would be the 24th, and we hear that 28th Brigade is going to take over. I think it was on the night of the 26th, at 23:59, they would take over, and we'll no longer be 27th Brigade, so we've got about 24 hours to go before they take over. They, all quiet, no attack made, couldn't believe it really, because we expected them to come zooming up the gully in front of us, and we'd be fighting for our lives. Anyway, reasonably quiet, as nights are, and we settled down, we stood down to 50% at I guess shortly after midnight, we went to 50% stand two. It was all so quiet. And Bill, Will and I, my signaller that is, and myself, we decide to do an hour on and an hour off. And we've got an NCO, obviously, a prowler, and the lads are doing 50% in the slip trenches. Anyway, it's not working out very well because I really got to keep getting up and going round and, you know, making sure everybody's awake. Because the trouble with this, people, when they're very, very tired, as you are after some action like this, they are a bit inclined to pop off to sleep, and that even the NCOs could be. They're not, but I mean, they could be. And Will said, well, I'll tell you what, if you hold the handset, I'll keep the earphones on. We've got to be on radio watch, you'll appreciate, all night long. He said, I'll keep the earphones on. If it comes in over the radio, I'll hear it. It'll wake me up anyway. And you've got the handset, so you can do the chat. So that we settled down to that. And I guess it would be about 0200, something like that, we suddenly start getting shelled. It's right on us, all in amongst us. And you know, you could hear the shrapnel, the fragments cutting the trees and bushes and things and flashing and what have you. And we're crouched in the bottom of our slit trenches. And I suddenly realised I've got hold of Will's wrist. I'm hanging on to him. I don't know what made me think so, but he moved. I'm laying across his legs, and his legs moved. And I thought, he's trying to get out of the bloody trench. But he wasn't, in actual fact. What had happened was I was pressing down on him and his legs were aching. And we could hear the FFO on the radio swearing back at his people there, you know, who were shooting up and what the hell's happened. It all suddenly stopped. I guess there were about three or four salvos, maybe three. It always seems more. But I say three salvos, and I guess they were all about four shells apiece. I thought they were 155 at the time, but I know now that they couldn't have been. They must have been 105. Anyway, he calls over to me when it's all stopped and said, it's not us. It's an American unit has just moved in, and they've fired some ranging. Instead of firing single shots of ranging, they've fired salvos of ranging. And, of course, they've landed them right on the top of us. So I quickly go around. No casualties at all, nothing at all. Obviously been some near misses, but I can't really see in the dark. And the old radio crackles into any, you know, casualties and what have you. And I'm doing my old, what the hell's the call sign again. And we get shot of that. Morning comes, and we stand to. Nothing happened all night. We've been very, very lucky. Although it appears they've been attacking the Canadians during the night. They've given us the miss and gone for the Canadians. And there must have been shell fire all night. In fact, all the records later say there was shell fire all night. In fact, I think they fired about 10,000 rounds, the New Zealanders. But that's never registered with me, so I don't remember that at all. Morning stand to, as soon as it gets light, I take a walk around to see what damage has been done, where these shells have landed. And of course, as I think I've said before, they just make a crater about as big as a dinner plate, and all the bits fly around all over the place. And the closest was, some probably skimmed over the top of our heads, but the closest that we had was one that had landed on the parapet of the two of the new lads' trench there. And fortunately, they had their weapons inside their slit, not over the top. Probably pulled them back as the shells started to land. And there's just in the spoil on the front, there's one of these, well, a bit bigger than usual, you know, say two or 3 feet. Across a shallow depression, and then all around the position, and the trees and bushes are